The example above will have seemed poorly chosen. Its explanatory purpose will have been ignored. Politics can do this, and so can religion. Some views are held so deeply that if a speaker seems to be threatening them, people go into a different mode. Instead of listening, they shut down and smolder. This is a very big problem. One of the most consequential pieces of public speaking in recent times has been the presentation Al Gore began making in 2005 that was turned into the documentary An Inconvenient Truth, proclaiming a global climate crisis. He made powerful use of every talk technique you can imagine. Compelling slides, careful logic, eloquence, humor, passionate advocacy, devastating mockery of opposing views, and even a touching personal story about his daughter. When he gave the presentation at a special off-the-record session of TED, it profoundly impacted the lives of many participants, persuading some to chuck in their jobs and work full-time on climate issues. There was one problem, though. Al Gore was a politician in a country sharply divided on partisan lines. Our partisan instincts build near-impregnable barriers against propaganda from the other side. Half of the country connected more deeply with Gore than ever, embraced an inconvenient truth, and had their worldviews permanently altered. The other half never connected at all. They simply shut it out. The very fact that it was Gore, the politician, making the case meant that it couldn't be true. A decade later, the climate issue was as politicized as ever. What should be a matter of science had tragically become a test of political alignment. It's possible the same thing would have happened on the left if Dick Cheney or Karl Rove had led the charge on a major global issue. The toxicity of our political and religious non-conversations is a true tragedy of the modern world. When people aren't prepared or ready to listen, communication can't happen. If you want to reach people who radically disagree with you, your only chance is to put yourself in their shoes as best you can. Don't use language that may trigger tribal responses. Start with a vision of the world as seen through their eyes, and use every one of the tools described here to build a connection based on your shared humanity. Happily, most speaking opportunities are with fundamentally welcoming audiences. You should readily be able to make a connection with them, and then your talk can truly shine. 6. Narration. The irresistible allure of stories. Stories helped make us who we are. I mean this literally. The best evidence from archaeology and anthropology suggests that the human mind co-evolved with storytelling. About a million years ago, our hominid ancestors began gaining control of the use of fire, and it seems to have had a profound impact on their development. Warmth, yes. Defense against predators, yes. Cooking and its remarkable consequences for the growth of our brains, yes. But there was something else. Fire created a new magnet for social bonding. Its warmth and flickering light drew people together after dark. This seems to have happened in every ancient hunter-gatherer culture over the last 300,000 years. And what did they do with this time together? It seems that in many cultures, one form of social interaction became prevalent: storytelling. Anthropologist Polly Wiesner has spent 40 years researching certain forager cultures and periodically recording who said what and when. In 2014, she published a paper that showed a dramatic difference between daytime and nighttime gatherings. Daytime talk, even when larger groups were involved, centered on economic discussions and social gossip. At night, the mood mellowed. There might be singing, dancing, rituals. But the most time was spent on storytelling. Tales that brought people from distant places to the hearth and into the hearts and minds of listeners. Tales of people alive and dead, present and distant. Tales evoking hilarity, tension, and awe. Tales told by men, tales told by women. Often, the star storytellers were elders. In some cases, they had lost their sight, but were still venerated for their oral storytelling. Professor Wiesner told me that these stories played a crucial role in helping expand people's ability to imagine and to dream and understand the minds of others. They allowed human minds to explore vast social networks and to build imagined communities far beyond the borders of their local social group. Stories brought social status to great storytellers and actionable insights to great listeners. For example, an attentive listener could learn how to avoid the life-threatening dangers described in a story. Therefore, those narrating and listening skills are likely to have been selected for as modern humans evolved. So it's not just that we all love hearing stories. They probably helped shape how our minds share and receive information. Certainly, the power of stories has continued to this day, as evidenced by the multi-billion dollar industries built around novels, movies, and TV. And it's no surprise to discover that many of the best talks are anchored in storytelling. Unlike challenging explanations or complex arguments, everyone can relate to stories. They typically have a simple linear structure that makes them easy to follow. You just let the speaker take you on a journey, one step at a time. Thanks to our long history around campfires, our minds are really good at tracking along. And a natural part of listening to stories is that you empathize with the experiences of the characters. You find yourself immersed in their thoughts and emotions. In fact, you physically feel what they feel. If they're stressed or excited or exhilarated, so are you. And that makes you care about the outcome. Your attention is held. What are the elements of a great story? Well, the classic formula is a protagonist with goals meets an unexpected obstacle and a crisis results. The protagonist attempts to overcome the obstacle, leading to a climax, and finally a denouement. There can also be interruptions and plot twists. When it comes to sharing a story from the stage, remember to emphasize four key things. Base it on a character your audience can empathize with. Build tension, whether through curiosity, social intrigue, or actual danger. Offer the right level of detail. Too little and the story is not vivid, too much and it gets bogged down. End with a satisfying resolution, whether funny, moving, or revealing. Of course, it's all in the execution, so it's really worth fine-tuning your stories. Often, especially with stories from our own lives, we overstuff with details that are important to us, but that a wider audience just doesn't need to know. Or worse, we forget an essential piece of context, without which the story doesn't make much sense. Here's a great story. Once, when I was 8 years old, my father took me fishing. We were in a tiny boat 5 miles from shore when a massive storm blew in. Dad put a life jacket on me and whispered in my ear, "Do you trust me, son?" I nodded. He threw me overboard. I kid you not. Just tossed me over. I hit the water and bobbed up to the surface, gasping for breath. It was shockingly cold. The waves were terrifying, monstrous. Then Dad dived in after me. We watched in horror as our little boat flipped and sank, but he was holding me the whole time, telling me it was going to be okay. 15 minutes later, the Coast Guard helicopter arrived. It turned out that Dad knew the boat was damaged and was going to sink, and he had called them with our exact location. He guessed that it was better to chuck me in the open sea than risk getting trapped when the boat flipped. And that is how I learned the true meaning of the word trust. And here's how not to tell it. I learned trust from my father when I was 8 years old, and we got caught in a storm while out fishing for mackerel. We failed to catch a single one before the storm hit. Dad knew the boat was going to sink because it was one of those Saturn brand inflatable boats, which are usually pretty strong, but this one had been punctured once, and Dad thought it might happen again. In any case, the storm was too big for an inflatable boat, and it was already leaking, so he called the Coast Guard Rescue Service, who back then were available 24/7, unlike today. He told them our location, and then, to avoid the risk of getting trapped underwater, he put a life jacket on me and threw me overboard before jumping in himself. We then waited for the Coast Guard to come, and sure enough, 15 minutes later, the helicopter showed up. I think it was a Sikorsky MH-60 Jayhawk, and we were fine. The first story has a character you care about and intense drama that builds to incredulity before being beautifully resolved. The second version is a mess. The drama is killed by revealing the father's intent too early. There's no attempt to share the actual experience of the kid. There are too many details included that are irrelevant to most of the audience, while other germane details, like the giant waves, are ignored. Worst of all, the key line that anchors the story, "Do you trust me, son?" is lost. If you're going to tell a story, make sure you know why you're telling it, and try to edit out all the details that are not needed to make your point, while still leaving enough in for people to vividly imagine what happened. Some of the greatest talks are built around a single story. This structure offers the speaker huge benefits. The through line is taken care of. It's simply the narrative arc of the story. Provided the story is compelling, you can evoke an intense response in the audience. If the story is about you, you will create empathy for some of the things you care most about. It's easy to remember what you're going to say, because the structure is linear and your brain is extremely comfortable recalling one event right after another. Many speakers therefore use a speaking slot simply to share their own story. It's the simplest, easiest to prepare type of talk there is, and there's a comfort to it. You know your story. You certainly know more about it than anyone in the audience. If your journey has been remarkable, and if there's a coherence to the narrative, this type of talk can work really well. But there's a trap here too. Remember, the goal is to give. Personal stories sometimes fail to do that. They may entertain or intrigue or boost the speaker's ego, but they don't automatically give the audience something they can walk away with. Insights, actionable information, perspective, context, hope. And that's a real shame. One of the biggest reasons we turn down applications to speak at TED is when we're offered compelling anecdotes, but no central idea that wraps the narrative together. This is heartbreaking because the speakers are often wonderful, fascinating people, but without the wraparound of an idea, it's an opportunity missed. The key shift needed is an artful edit of your journey that links together critical moments in a way that someone else can derive meaning from them. Without that, even if your life has been impressive, the talk may feel rambling and self-indulgent. But if the journey reveals something powerful you have learned, and if each step in your journey is revealed with humility and honesty and vulnerability, it is a journey we will gladly make with you. There's one other non-negotiable essential if you're to tell your own story. It has to be true. This may seem obvious, but alas, speakers are sometimes tempted to exaggerate or even fabricate. Precisely because a story can have so much impact, they want to cast themselves or their organizations in the best possible light, and they sometimes cross that line called truth. Doing this is the easiest way to destroy your reputation. When talks go public, there may be thousands of eyes watching them. It only takes one person to notice that something's not quite right, and you can find yourself in hot water. It's not worth the risk. When you combine a truthful story with a desire to use it for others' benefit, you can give your listeners an extraordinary gift. Psychologist Eleanor Longdon was willing to share publicly how, at university, she began hearing voices in her head, and how that led to her being diagnosed with schizophrenia, institutionalized and driven to the point of suicide. The story alone is riveting, but she builds it so that you leave the talk with inspiring insights on schizophrenia, mental illness, and how we might rethink our responses to them. Here's part of the ending. "There is no greater honor or privilege than facilitating that process of healing for someone, to bear witness, to reach out a hand, to share the burden of someone's suffering, and to hold the hope for their recovery. And likewise, for survivors of distress and adversity, that we don't have to live our lives forever defined by the damaging things that have happened to us. We are unique. We are irreplaceable. What lies within us can never be truly colonized, contorted, or taken away. The light never goes out." Explorer Ben Saunders went on a trek to the South Pole that almost took his life. He's a powerful storyteller and has great photographs to illustrate what happened. As he drew near the end of his talk, we waited expectantly for the usual admonitions adventurers offer us to go out and discover our true selves in whatever challenge we take on. But Ben surprised us. He shared some dark moments he'd experienced since the trek and said the destination he'd been dreaming of for years was less satisfying than the journey. The takeaway? Don't pin your happiness on the future. Quote, if we can't feel content here, today, now, on our journeys, amidst the mess and the striving that we all inhabit, the open loops, the half-finished to-do lists, the could-do-better-next-times, then we might never feel it. Writer Andrew Solomon described how he was humiliated as a child, even before he came out as gay, and turned the story into an exhilarating essay on identity that anyone could relate to and learn from. Quote, there's always somebody who wants to confiscate our humanity, and there are always stories that restore it. If we live out loud, we can trounce the hatred and expand everyone's lives. Sir Ken Robinson's hilarious celebration of the importance of creativity in children is anchored in a story. He describes how a doctor in the 1930s noticed that a young girl who was failing at school had an irresistible desire to dance. Instead of medicating her, he persuaded her mother to send her to dance school. The girl was Gillian Lynn, who became the hugely successful choreographer for Andrew Lloyd Webber. The story, told in Sir Ken's inimitable style, is a moving illustration of the perils and potential in how schools handle creativity, and it is the part of the talk that turns hilarity into inspiration. Some stories are carefully designed as metaphors. There's a useful word for this type of story. Parable. Traditionally, a parable is a story that carries a moral or spiritual lesson. It's a tool that's been used by religious teachers throughout history to great effect. The stories of Jesus, I think we can agree, have clocked up even more views than Sir Ken's. But we can extend the word's meaning to cover any story that carries with it the power of metaphor. Law professor Lawrence Lessig is a brilliant purveyor of parables. He came to TED in 2013 to argue that America's political process had become irredeemably corrupted by money. He had us imagine a foolish country called Lesterland, in which only the people named Lester were able to vote. Clearly that would be ridiculous. But then he pointed out that the number of people named Lester in the US is about the same as the number of significant political funders, and that members of Congress have their priorities largely set by those funders, so that, effectively, it's only the funders whose views and votes matter. In this parable, we all live in Lesterland. Writer Malcolm Gladwell also specializes in parables, and the appeal of this form is reflected in the amazing sales of his books and the high number of views on his TED Talks. His most popular talk is, believe it or not, a tale about the development of new forms of spaghetti sauce. But he uses it as a parable for the insight that different people want very different things, but often don't have the language to say what they want until you find the right questions to ask them. What's satisfying about each of these talks is the way they draw out the meaning from the story. You don't want to insult the intelligence of the audience by force-feeding exactly the conclusion they must draw from the tale you've told, but you absolutely do want to be sure there's enough there for your listeners to be able to connect the dots. And this is where knowing your audience well is important. A parable might work very well with an audience that already knows your field, but it will need much greater elucidation for those outside it. It's important to test your material on someone who knows the audience to see if it lands with clarity, but without clumsiness. There are plenty of other risks in going the parable route. Sometimes the analogy doesn't quite fit. It can mislead as much as enlighten. Or you can spend so much time telling the story that you miss drawing out the necessary conclusions. But in the right hands, a parable can entertain, inform, and inspire all in one. There is another powerful function that stories offer, explanation. For this purpose, they aren't usually the main attraction, but more the support. And they usually come in the form of short inserts designed to illustrate or reinforce an idea. We'll dig into this use of stories in the next chapter. Meanwhile, remember this. Stories resonate deeply in every human. By giving your talk as a story, or a series of related stories, you can greatly increase your connection with your listeners. But please, Let it mean something. 7. Explanation. How to explain tough concepts. Harvard psychologist Dan Gilbert came to TED with a daunting task. In just a single short talk, he planned to explain a sophisticated concept called synthesized happiness and why it led us to make wildly inaccurate predictions about our own futures. Let's see how he set about it. Here's how he begins. When you have 21 minutes to speak, 2 million years seems like a really long time. An opening line anchored in the here and now, but immediately creating intrigue. But evolutionarily, 2 million years is nothing. And yet, in 2 million years, the human brain has nearly tripled in mass, going from the 1¼-pound brain of our ancestor here, Homo habilis, to the almost 3-pound meatloaf that everybody here has between their ears. What is it about a big brain that nature was so eager for every one of us to have one? Do you feel a little spark of curiosity? That's the first step to a successful explanation. Once a mind is intrigued, it opens up. It wants new ideas. Gilbert continues to tease. Well, it turns out when brains triple in size, they don't just get 3 times bigger, they gain new structures. And one of the main reasons our brain got so big is because it got a new part called the prefrontal cortex. What does a prefrontal cortex do for you that should justify the entire architectural overhaul of the human skull in the blink of evolutionary time? While continuing to stoke our curiosity, Gilbert just slotted in the first concept he'll be building on, prefrontal cortex. One of the most important things it does, it's an experience simulator. Pilots practice in flight simulators so that they don't make real mistakes in planes. Human beings have this marvelous adaptation that they can actually have experiences in their heads before they try them out in real life. This is a trick that none of our ancestors could do and that no other animal can do quite like we can. It's a marvelous adaptation. It's up there with opposable thumbs and standing upright and language as one of the things that got our species out of the trees and into the shopping mall. Slipped in along with the humor, we get another cool new concept. Experience simulator. That's a key building block. It was dropped into place courtesy of a simple metaphor, the flight simulator. We already know what that is, so it's possible to imagine what an experience simulator might be. But could it be made clearer with an example? Yes, it could. Ben and Jerry's doesn't have liver and onion ice cream, and it's not because they whipped some up, tried it, and went yuck. It's because without leaving your armchair, you can simulate that flavor and say yuck before you make it. A single vivid example of the simulator in action, and you totally get it. But now the talk takes an intriguing twist. Let's see how your experience simulators are working. Let's just run a quick diagnostic before I proceed with the rest of the talk. Here are 2 different futures that I invite you to contemplate. You can try to simulate them and tell me which one you think you might prefer. One of them is winning the lottery, and the other is becoming paraplegic. The audience is laughing, but a little nervously, wondering what's to come. And what's to come is a truly astonishing slide. Gilbert shows us data suggesting that 1 year after winning the lottery or becoming a paraplegic, both groups are actually equally happy. What? That can't be right. This cool new concept of the experience simulator has suddenly taken you to a place you didn't expect. A baffling place. The facts you're presented with make no sense. You're experiencing a knowledge gap, and your mind is craving that it be filled. So, Gilbert proceeds to fill it by offering another new concept. The research that my laboratory has been doing has revealed something really quite startling to us, something we call the impact bias, which is the tendency for the simulator to work badly, to make you believe that different outcomes are more different than in fact they really are. By putting a name on it, impact bias, the mystery somehow becomes more believable. But our curiosity is burning more brightly than ever in its attempt to bridge this gap. Can it really be the case that we could mispredict our future happiness levels to this degree? Gilbert taps into that vein of curiosity to unveil his key concept. From field studies to laboratory studies, we see that winning or losing an election, gaining or losing a romantic partner, getting or not getting a promotion, passing or not passing a college test, on, have far less impact, less intensity, and much less duration than people expect them to have. This almost floors me. A recent study showing how major life traumas affect people suggests that if it happened over 3 months ago, with only a few exceptions, it has no impact whatsoever on your happiness. Why? Because happiness can be synthesized. Human beings have something that we might think of as a psychological immune system, a system of cognitive processes, largely non-conscious cognitive processes, that help them change their views of the world so that they can feel better about the worlds in which they find themselves. There it is. Synthetic happiness explained. It's been built on the concepts of prefrontal cortex, experience simulator, and impact bias. And to make it clear, Gilbert uses another metaphor, that of the immune system. You already know what an immune system is, so to think of this as a psychological immune system is easy. The concept is not delivered in a single leap, but piece by piece, and with metaphors to guide and show how the pieces fit together. But perhaps we're still not fully believing it, so Gilbert encourages us that he really does mean what he seems to be saying, by giving a series of examples of people's psychological immune systems at work. A disgraced politician who is grateful for his fall. A falsely convicted inmate who describes his 37 years in jail as a glorious experience. And Pete Best, the Fab Four's rejected drummer, who famously said, "I'm happier than I would have been with the Beatles." The examples really drive his point home. Gilbert goes on to show how this phenomenon can be observed everywhere and how you can live a wiser, happier life if you take it into account. After all, why do we chase happiness when we have the capacity within ourselves to manufacture the very commodity we crave? But already we've seen enough to reveal the core elements of a masterful explanation. Let's recap. Step one, he started right where we were. Both literally, when you have 21 minutes to speak, and conceptually, without daunting assumptions about our knowledge of psychology or neuroscience. Step two, he lit a fire called curiosity. Curiosity is what makes people ask why and how. It's the feeling that something doesn't quite make sense, that there's a knowledge gap that has to be closed. This happened right at the start, and then was dialed up dramatically with his unexpected data about paraplegics and lottery winners. Step three, he brought in concepts one by one. You can't understand the main concept without first being introduced to the pieces on which it depends. In this case, prefrontal cortex, experience simulator, and impact bias. Step four, he used metaphors. It took metaphors like the flight simulator and the psychological immune system to make clear what he was talking about. For an explanation to be satisfying, it has to take puzzling facts and build a connection from them to someone's existing mental model of the world. Metaphors and analogies are the key tools needed to do this. They help shape the explanation until finally it snaps into place with a satisfying aha. Step five, he used examples. Little stories like that of Pete Best help lock the explanation into place. This is like saying to the brain, "You think you understand this idea? Then apply it to these facts. If it fits, you've got this figured out." At the end of his explanation, our mental model of the world has been upgraded. It's richer, deeper, truer, a better reflection of reality. Explanation is the act that consciously adds a new element to someone's mental model or reorders existing elements in a more satisfying way. If, as I have suggested, the goal of a great talk is to build an idea inside someone's mind, then explanation is the essential tool for achieving that goal. Many of the best TED Talks achieve their greatness through masterful explanation. And there's a beautiful word for the gift they give, understanding. We can define it as the upgrading of a worldview to better reflect reality. There is evidence from numerous diverse sources, from neuroscience to psychology to educational theory, that this is how understanding must happen. It's built as a hierarchy, with each layer supplying the elements that construct the next layer. We start with what we know, and we add bits piece by piece, with each part positioned by using already understood language, backed by metaphors and examples. The metaphors, perhaps literally, reveal the shape of the new concept, so that the mind knows how to slot it in effectively. Without this shaping, the concepts can't be put in place. So a key part of planning a talk is to have the balance right between the concepts you are introducing and the examples and metaphors needed to make them understandable. Lexicographer Erin McKean offers this as a nice example of the power of metaphor. If you were giving a talk about JavaScript to a general audience, you could explain that people often have a mental model of a computer program as being a set of instructions executed one after another. But in JavaScript, instructions can be asynchronous, which means that you can't be confident that line 5 will always happen after line 4. Imagine if you were getting dressed in the morning and it was possible to put your shoes on before your jeans or your jeans on before your underpants. That can happen in JavaScript. A single sentence metaphor and click, the light comes on. If the core of your talk is explaining a powerful new idea, it is helpful to ask, what do you assume your audience already knows? What will be your connecting theme? What are the concepts necessary to build your explanation? And what metaphors and examples will you use to reveal those concepts? Unfortunately, this isn't that easy. We all suffer from a cognitive bias for which economist Robin Hogarth coined the term the curse of knowledge. In a nutshell, we find it hard to remember what it feels like not to know something that we ourselves know well. A physicist lives and breathes subatomic particles and may assume that everyone else, of course, knows what a charm quark is. I was shocked in a recent cocktail party discussion to hear a talented young novelist ask, "You keep using the term natural selection. What exactly do you mean by that?" I thought everyone with half an education understood the basic ideas of evolution. I was wrong. In The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century, Steven Pinker suggests that overcoming the curse of knowledge may be the single most important requirement in becoming a clear writer. If it's true about writing, when readers have a chance to pause and reread a sentence several times before continuing, then it's even more true about speaking. Pinker suggests that simply being conscious of this bias is not enough. You have to expose your drafts to friends or colleagues and beg for ruthless feedback on anything they don't understand. The same is true for talks, and especially those talks that seek to explain something complex. First, share a draft script with colleagues and friends, then try it out in front of a private audience, and specifically ask the questions, "Did that make sense? Was anything confusing?" I've long admired Pinker's ability to explain our mind's machinations, so I asked him for some more guidance here. He told me that for true understanding to take place, the full hierarchical structure of an idea must be communicated. Quote, "A major finding of cognitive psychology is that long-term memory depends on coherent hierarchical organization of content, chunks within chunks within chunks. A speaker's challenge is to use the fundamentally one-dimensional medium of speech, one word after another, to convey a multidimensional, hierarchical and cross-linking structure. A speaker begins with a web of ideas in his head, and by the very nature of language, he has to convert it into a string of words. This takes great care, right down to individual sentences and how they link. A speaker has to be sure that listeners know how each sentence relates logically to the preceding one, whether the relationship is similarity, contrast, elaboration, exemplification, generalization, before and after, cause, effect, or violated expectation. and they must know whether the point they are now pondering is a digression, a part of the main argument, an exception to the main argument, and so on. If you imagine the structure of an explanatory talk as a central through line with other parts connected to it, anecdotes, examples, amplifications, digressions, clarifications, etc., then overall, that structure may look like a tree. The through line is the trunk, and the branches are the various pieces attached to it. But for understanding to take place, it's crucial the listener knows where she is on that tree. This is often where the curse of knowledge strikes hardest. Every sentence is understandable, but the speaker forgets to show how they link together. To him, it's obvious. Here's a simple example. A speaker says, "Chimpanzees have vastly greater strength than humans. Humans learned how to use tools to amplify their natural strength. Of course, chimpanzees also use tools." And an audience is left confused. What is the point being made here? Maybe the speaker was trying to argue that tools matter more than strength, but didn't want to imply that chimpanzees never use tools? Or that chimpanzees are now capable of learning how to amplify their already greater strength? The three sentences don't connect, and the result is a muddle. The above should have been replaced with one of these. "Although chimpanzees have vastly greater strength than humans, humans are much better tool users, and those tools have amplified humans' natural strength far beyond that of chimpanzees." Or, and with very different meaning, "Chimpanzees have vastly greater strength than humans, and now we've discovered that they also use tools. They could use those tools to learn how to amplify their natural strength." What this means is that some of the most important elements in a talk are the little phrases that give clues to the talk's overall structure. "Although," "one recent example," "on the other hand." Let's build on that. Playing devil's advocate for a moment, I must just tell you two stories that amplify this finding. As an aside, at this point you may object that. So, in summary, equally important is the precise sequencing of sentences and concepts so that understanding can build naturally. In sharing early drafts of this book, there were countless occasions when people pointed out, "I think I get it, but it would be much clearer if you switch those two paragraphs and explain the link between them a little better." It's important to achieve clarity in a book, and it's even more important to have clarity in a talk. Ultimately, your best bet is to recruit help from people new to the topic, because they will be best at spotting the gaps. TED speaker Deborah Gordon, who explained how ant colonies can teach us crucial networking ideas, told me that the quest for explanation gaps was a crucial part of talk preparation. Quote, "A talk isn't a container or a bin that you put content in. It's a process, a trajectory. The goal is to take the listener from where he is to someplace new. That means trying to make the sequence so stepwise that no one gets lost along the way. Not to be grandiose, but if you could fly and you wanted someone to fly with you, you would take their hand and take off and not let go, because once the person drops, that's it. I rehearsed in front of friends and acquaintances who knew nothing about the topic, asking them where they were puzzled or what they wondered about, hoping that by filling those gaps for them, I'd be filling the same gaps for other people." It's especially important to do a jargon check. Any technical terms or acronyms that may be unfamiliar to your listeners should be eliminated or explained. Nothing frustrates an audience more than to hear a 3-minute discussion of TLAs when they have no idea what TLAs are. TLA equals 3-letter acronym. Maybe one such transgression could be handled, but when jargon terms pile up, people simply switch off. I am not advocating that everything be explained on a level appropriate for 6th graders. At TED, we have a guideline based on Einstein's dictum, "Make everything as simple as it can be, but no simpler." It's not clear he said it in exactly those words, but the idea is credited to him. You don't want to insult your audience's intelligence. Sometimes specialist terms are essential. For most audiences, you don't have to spell out that DNA is a special molecule that carries unique genetic information. And you don't have to over-explain. Indeed, the best explainers say just enough to let people feel like they're coming up with the idea for themselves. Their strategy is to bring in the new concept and describe its shape just enough so that the prepared minds of the audience can snap it into place for themselves. That's time efficient for you and deeply satisfying for them. By the end of the talk, they're basking in the glow of their own smarts. There's one other key explanation tool. Before you try to build your idea, consider making clear what it isn't. You'll notice I've used that technique in this book already, for example, by discussing talk styles that don't work before going on to those that do. If an explanation is building a small mental model in a large space of possibilities, it's helpful first to reduce the size of that space. By ruling out plausible possibilities, you make it a lot easier for your audience to close in on what it is you have in mind. When, for instance, neuroscientist Sandra Amott wanted to explain why mindfulness was helpful for dieting, she said, "I'm not saying you need to learn to meditate or take up yoga. I'm talking about mindful eating. Learning to understand your body's signals so that you eat when you're hungry and stop when you're full." Superb TED Talk explainers include Hans Rosling, Revelatory Animated Charts, David Deutsch, Outside the Box Scientific Thinking, Nancy Kanwisher, Accessible Neuroscience, Stephen Johnson, Where Ideas Come From, and David Christian, History on a Grand Canvas. I thoroughly recommend them all. They each build inside you something new and powerful that you will value forever. If you can explain something well, you can use that ability to create real excitement in your audience. Bonnie Bassler is a scientist working on how bacteria communicate with each other. She gave a talk that dove into some pretty complex but mind-blowing research her lab had been undertaking. By helping us understand it, she opened up a world of intriguing possibilities. Here's how. She started by making the talk relevant to us. After all, it's not a given that someone in the audience actually cared that much about bacteria. So she began like this. "I know you guys think of yourself as humans, and this is sort of how I think of you. There's about a trillion human cells that make each one of us who we are and able to do all the things that we do. But you have 10 trillion bacterial cells in you or on you at any moment in your life. So 10 times more bacterial cells than human cells on a human being. These bacteria are not passive riders. They are incredibly important. They keep us alive. They cover us in an invisible body armor that keeps environmental insults out so that we stay healthy. They digest our food. They make our vitamins. They actually educate your immune system to keep bad microbes out. So they do all these amazing things that help us and are vital for keeping us alive. And they never get any press for that." Okay, now it's personal. These bugs matter to us. Next, an unexpected question stirs our curiosity. The question we had is, how could they do anything at all? I mean, they're incredibly small. You have to have a microscope to see one. They live this sort of boring life where they grow and divide, and they've always been considered to be these asocial, reclusive organisms. And so it seemed to us that they are just too small to have an impact on the environment if they simply act as individuals. This is getting intriguing. She's going to tell us that somehow bacteria hunt in packs. I'm eager to know more. Bonnie then takes us on a detective's investigation through various clues that point to how bacteria must act in concert. There's an amazing story about a bioluminescent squid that uses the synced-up behavior of bacteria to make itself invisible. And finally, we get to her discovery of how invasive bacteria might launch an attack on a human. They can't do it individually. Instead, they emit a communication molecule. As more bacteria multiply in your body, the concentration of this molecule increases until suddenly they all know collectively that there are enough of them to attack. And they all begin emitting toxins at the same time. It's called quorum sensing. Wow. She said this discovery opened up new strategies for fighting bacteria. Don't kill them, just cut their communication channels. With antibiotic immunity spreading, that is a truly exciting concept. Then she ended her talk by teasing up an even broader implication. "I would argue that this is the invention of multicellularity. Bacteria have been on the earth for billions of years, humans a couple hundred thousand. We think bacteria made the rules for how multicellular organization works. If we can figure them out in these primitive organisms, the hope is that they will be applied to other human diseases and human behaviors as well. At every stage of Bonnie's talk, each piece was carefully built only on what came before. There was not a single piece of jargon that wasn't explained. And that gave her the ability to open new doors of possibility for us. It was complex science, but it got our non-expert audience wildly excited. And at the end, much to her astonishment, we all stood and applauded her. You can't give a powerful new idea to an audience unless you can learn how to explain. That can only be done step by step, fueled by curiosity. Each step builds on what the listener already knows. Metaphors and examples are essential to revealing how an idea is pieced together. Beware the curse of knowledge. You must be sure you're not making assumptions that will lose your audience. And when you've explained something special, excitement and inspiration will follow close behind. 8. Persuasion. Reason can change minds forever. If explanation is building a brand new idea inside someone's mind, persuasion is a little more radical. Before construction, it first requires some demolition. Persuasion means convincing an audience that the way they currently see the world isn't quite right. And that means taking down the parts that aren't working, as well as rebuilding something better. When this works, it's thrilling for both speaker and audience. Cognitive scientist Steven Pinker blew up my mental model of violence. Anyone who grows up on a normal media diet assumes that our world is crippled by constant violence, wars, murders, assaults, terrorism, and that it seems to be getting worse. Pinker, in just 18 minutes, persuaded the TED audience that this assumption was dead wrong. That actually, when you pulled the camera back and looked at the real data, the world is becoming less violent, and that this trend has extended across years, decades, centuries, and millennia. How did he do it? Well, first, with a little demolition. Our minds need to be primed before they can be persuaded. Pinker started by reminding people how hideous some of the violent practices of earlier eras had been, like the French public entertainment of 500 years ago, of lowering live cats into a fire to hear them shriek. Or the fact that in many ancient societies, more than a third of adult males died in violence. Essentially, he was saying, you may think violence is getting worse, but you've forgotten just how awful it really was historically. Then he showed how modern media have an incentive to lead with stories of drama and violence, regardless of whether those events are representative of life as a whole. He was revealing a mechanism by which we might plausibly be overestimating the actual levels of violence out there. With this priming in place, it was much easier to take seriously his statistics and charts, which showed substantial declines in all forms of violence, from murder to major wars. One key strategy here was to present the stats as relative to population size. What matters is not the total number of violent deaths, but the chance that you individually will meet a violent death. He went on to discuss four possible explanations for this unexpected trend and ended with this beautifully upbeat statement. Whatever its cause is, the decline of violence, I think, has profound implications. It should force us to ask not just, why is there war, but also, why is there peace? Not just, what are we doing wrong, but also, what have we been doing right? Because we have been doing something right, and it sure would be good to find out what it is. The talk led 4 years later to a major book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, which further developed his argument. Let's assume that Pinker is right. If so, he has given a beautiful gift to millions of people. Most of us spend our whole lives under the assumption that the daily news is forever getting worse and that wars and terrorism and violence are out of control. When you replace that with the possibility that even though things can be bad, they're actually on an upward trend, what a cloud that lifts. Persuasion can alter someone's outlook forever. Psychologist Barry Schwartz changed the way I think about choice. In the West, we're obsessed with maximizing choice. Freedom is our mantra. and maximizing choice is the way to maximize freedom. Schwartz begs to differ. In his talk on the paradox of choice, he gradually builds the case that, in numerous circumstances, too much choice actually makes us unhappy. His demolition toolkit was surprisingly painless. He mixed snippets of psychological theory with a series of examples ranging from health insurance behavior to a frustrating shopping experience, all interspersed with delightful on-topic New Yorker cartoons. The ideas were counterintuitive, but the journey was thoroughly enjoyable, and we almost didn't notice that a worldview we all grew up with was being smashed to pieces. Author Elizabeth Gilbert showed how the power of storytelling can be a key part of the persuasion toolkit. Her goal was to change the way we thought about creative genius. Instead of imagining that genius is part of some people's makeup and you either have it or you don't, think of it as something that you may receive from time to time as a gift if you make yourself ready for it. Put just like that, it may not sound very convincing, but Gilbert used her brilliance as a storyteller to persuade us otherwise. She opened up with her own tale of terror at the prospect of having to repeat the success of her bestseller, Eat, Pray, Love, and shared hilarious and touching stories of famous creatives beset by angst over their inability to perform on demand. She also showed how the term genius was viewed differently in history, not as something you were, but as something that came to you. Only then could she share a story about the poet Ruth Stone, who told her of the moment when she sensed that a poem was coming. And she felt it coming because it would shake the earth under her feet. She knew that she had only one thing to do at that point, and that was to, in her words, run like hell. And she would run like hell to the house, and she would be getting chased by this poem. And the whole deal was that she had to get to a piece of paper and a pencil fast enough so that when it thundered through her, she could collect it and grab it on the page. What would have seemed an outlandish story if presented at the start of the talk seemed thoroughly natural by the end, and it cemented her core idea into place. In each case, the key to prompting that worldview shift is to take the journey one step at a time, priming our minds in several different ways before getting to the main argument. What do I mean by priming? The philosopher Daniel Dennett explains it best. He coined the term intuition pump to refer to any metaphor or linguistic device that intuitively makes a conclusion seem more plausible. This is priming. It is not a rigorous argument. It is simply a way of nudging someone in your direction. Barry Schwartz's shopping story was an intuition pump. Had he just gone straight to, "Too many choices can make you unhappy," we might have been skeptical. Instead, he primed us. Quote, "There was a time when jeans came in one flavor and you bought them and they fit like crap, they were really uncomfortable, but if you wore them and washed them enough times, they started to feel okay. I went to replace my jeans after years of wearing these old ones, and I said, 'I want a pair of jeans, here's my size,' and the shopkeeper said, 'Do you want slim fit, easy fit, relaxed fit? You want button fly or zipper fly? You want stone washed or acid washed? Do you want them distressed? You want boot cut, tapered, blah, blah, blah?'" As he tells the story, we sense his stress, and we remember all the times we have ourselves been stressed by endless shopping excursions. Even though his story is a single story of a single man and can't possibly by itself justify the statement that too much choice makes you unhappy, nonetheless, we get where he is heading. Suddenly, the case he's building seems a lot more plausible. Dennett points out that many of the most revered passages of philosophical writing are not reasoned arguments, but powerful intuition pumps, like Plato's Cave or Descartes' Demon. In the latter, Descartes wanted to doubt everything that could be doubted, so he imagined his entire conscious experience as a deception foisted on him by a malicious demon. The demon could have invented the entire world he thought he saw. The only thing Descartes could be certain of was the experience of thinking and doubting. But that at least meant he existed. Hence, I think, therefore I am. Without the demon, the logic is hard to fathom. Our minds are not robotic logic machines. They need to be nudged in the right direction, and intuition pumps are vivid ways to do this. Once people have been primed, it's much easier to make your main argument. And how do you do that? By using the most noble tool of them all, a tool that can wield the most impact over the very long term. And it's named using an old-fashioned philosophical word that I love. Reason. The thing about reason is that it's capable of delivering a conclusion at a whole different level of certainty than any other mental tool. In a reasoned argument, provided the starting assumptions are true, then the validly reasoned conclusions must also be true and can be known to be true. If you can walk someone through a reasoned argument convincingly, the idea you have planted in her mind will lodge there and never let go. But for the process to work, it must be broken down into small steps, each of which must be totally convincing. The starting point of each step is something the audience can clearly see to be true, or it's something that was shown to be true earlier in the talk. So the core mechanism here is if-then. If X is true, dear friends, then, clearly, Y follows, because every X implies a Y. One of the TED Talks rated most persuasive is that of charity reformer Dan Palotta, who argues that the way we think about charity means that our non-profit organizations are hopelessly handicapped. To make his case, he takes five different aspects of an organization: salary levels, marketing expectations, willingness to take risks, time allowed for impact, and access to capital. In each case, he uses razor-sharp language, backed by beautiful infographics, to show an absurd dichotomy between